Log Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you pay, but I got to put you down.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in once again to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. It seems like I'm saying that more and more slowly as time goes by. I don't know if I'm getting slower or what's going on. Maybe I just want you guys to understand. Maybe I just want you guys to understand what a big boxing weekend we have coming up this weekend. Nothing huge, nothing massive in terms of name value, but it's good. It's good stuff. This is the kind of boxing weekend boxing fans tend to really relish. Good, high-quality matchups, competitive fights, for the most part free. Even though they're on networks, you know, those aren't free. But still, we're not having to pay $60, $70, $80 for these fights. And this is good stuff. This weekend, this weekend is a boxing fans weekend, no question about it. That's what you're probably going to be hearing for the next little while with my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler and I. And, of course, I get so caught up in what's going on this weekend, I didn't even introduce myself. If you're listening in and it's a minute and a half into the show and you're going, who the fuck is this guy? Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, The Fight City, a couple other places, and this is going to be fun stuff today. That's what you're going to be hearing over and over and over, hopefully. And hey, we're being optimistic for a change. That being said, I'm going to be calling up my buddy Bryn here. Let's see what's going down.
I'm sorry, the person you are trying to reach has a voicemail box that has not been set up yet. Please try your call again later. Goodbye.
You can't not set up your voicemail, Bryn. Come on now. Oh, man. I'll call him back in a second. The probably the main fight that's happening this weekend, for a couple different reasons, is the rematch between Carl Frampton and Leo Santa Cruz on Showtime. I say that's the main fight, probably because it has the biggest name value to it. Carl Frampton is, of course, a star in Northern Ireland in particular, and Leo Santa Cruz is a fairly popular fighter among most boxing fans. Of course, neither of them are really mainstream fighters, but they fought this past summer and had a wonderful fight. I think that's probably one of the biggest reasons here why this is the fight to look out for this weekend. The first fight was great. It had a whole lot of action and back and forth action too. It wasn't particularly one-sided. It was very competitive, and they're running it back. They're two fighters who are kind of, they wasted no time in saying, let's go right back into it. And that's something that, especially in this day and age, I think you have to respect, especially on the heels of Badou Jack versus James DeGale, which itself was a very fun fight. But immediately afterwards, both Badou Jack and Floyd Mayweather said, no, no rematch, not happening. Nope, not going to happen. We're not interested. And while on one hand, you can't really blame them for saying that, they don't want that kind of fight again. I would guess that that probably falls under the umbrella of reasons why they don't want that fight again. And by that, I mean just they don't want that kind of fight again. They don't want that arduous of a fight again. But also, you know, the weight issue, and I understand that. It's just still disappointing. And so to, you know, basically see two guys just say, back in with each other, that's inspiring. Speaking of inspiring, Bryn.
I'm here.
Bryn, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but you need to set up your voicemail.
It will never happen. I've successfully not had it for 7 years now. It's a point of pride.
That's like not having a Facebook account. You know how some people are all like braggy about that? That's pretty close.
Well, it's more just on principle that coming to New York and leaving behind $50,000 worth of debt to Canadian banks and credit card companies, I was always available to discuss it. I just never answered the phone.
That's not a bad strategy.
Seems to work okay so far, knock on wood. Yeah.
Yeah, I've used worse dodging strategies, no question. So the big takeaway, of course, here is this weekend, big boxing weekend, nothing too crazy, nothing massive, no gnarly pay-per-views or anything like that. We're probably not going to be breaking the bank anywhere, but these are just good, competitive fights. What's your favorite here?
Oh, the Frampton. Frampton and Leo. That's just,
yeah.
Hard to not see that being a great fight.
It's, I was just saying, it's just, you know, it's really refreshing too that both of them just kind of were like, yeah, why wouldn't we do this again? Of course we're going to do it again. And then, you know, on the heels of Badou Jack versus James DeGale, which, and I'm not trying to disparage either fighter because I understand, but still, it's disappointing that you get such a good fight and then immediately afterwards, and I mean immediately, one side's going, no rematch. No, we're good. We're fine. It's like, really? You're fine with that draw? You're fine with the draw. Okay. All right. It's just, it's really refreshing to then see two fighters just say, whatever, man. It was a great fight. Let's do it again.
Yeah. And that's why both of these guys have pretty big fan bases and I think appeal to sort of boxing nuts and just general sports fans alike. I really, really enjoyed their first fight, and I totally agree with you. Just to cut through the red tape to make it happen sort of, I don't know, puts up a flag to other people that just, you know, like we see with Amir Khan and Kell Brook, I mean, not even a rematch, but just such an obvious fight that people want to see, especially those UK fans where, I mean, with what Joshua Klitschko is doing, selling out 90,000 seats in a few days, it seems like. It's just hard to imagine that when you're in your prime, you don't want to set up those kind of fights. Especially if you put on good ones, there's going to be a lot more money for rematches down the road. So I hope something like this kind of galvanizes other people in a position to make exciting fights to do just that, because where was the drama in creating this? Both guys just seem to be grown-ups in setting it up, and just, it hopefully makes dollars and cents to just do that. Make it easy and keep the focus on the boxing, like, you know, exciting, good-quality boxing. There are just so many examples of the contrary that are, you know, Ward Kovalev being the obvious example.
It's going to kind of be tough to get off of that Ward Kovalev subject, to be honest. I mean, that's easily one of the biggest fights in the sport. It already happened, and I mean, and it was a great fight. It was an entertaining fight, and that kind of doesn't get said enough. That the fight was entertaining, it was back and forth, it was, you know, had a couple nice swings of momentum, and both fighters gave impressive performances in one way or another. And then for it to just be stalling out like this, and, you know, I've had my own reservations about Kovalev, and I don't want to get too, you know, like too sucked into this subject, but I've had my own reservations about Kovalev and everything, but I have absolutely no question about who he is as a fighter. And the kind of fighter he is. And the kind of fighter he is the kind of fighter that says, put the dude in front of me, I will punch him. But absolutely no doubt that rematch is getting held up because of Andre Ward. And so it's just disappointing. And it's really nice to see the opposite of that, to see just guys say, let's just do it, man. You know, and that, it's just, it's nice to be able to get to that point sometimes in the sport that's just so frustrating and so difficult to manage as a fan and so difficult to stand by. And it's not like, you know, it's not like divas in boxing were just invented yesterday or anything like that. They've been around for a very long time, but at the same time, it really does kind of harken back to that just kind of warrior aspect of the sport where it's just about the fighting.
Yeah, and I also think in the case of Andre Ward, I think what I object to is how disingenuous he's been in terms of throwing up this, you know, we need to renegotiate. Clearly, I'm the A side after winning. There's nothing to negotiate. It was negotiated. There's a rematch clause. If you want to fight again, honor your clause. You know, honor your word. If you go on and on lecturing us about your humility and your stand-up character and how unfair critics are towards you, this is pretty basic. Honor a contract that you signed. You know, you didn't have to sign it. You did. You made $5 million from Jay-Z, you know, for surviving a fight. So if you're so concerned with your legacy, just honor your contract and don't pretend like there's anything to negotiate. It's already been negotiated. I loathe that kind of disingenuousness. And I don't know, just I've dealt with people like that who want to sort of renegotiate or relitigate things after it's already been settled. And it's terrible to do business with those kind of people. And I think you're seeing also with Amir Khan, the way that he's sort of in social media litigated the parameters of fighting against Kell Brook are just embarrassing. And it's weird for me, too. I haven't spent a lot of time with Amir Khan, but a conversation that always stood out for me was the first time I met him. He was stranded because of visa issues in Vancouver, I want to say 2010, 2011. And so I had dinner with him and Freddie Roach. He was kind of mystified because nobody knew who he was, you know, as was kind of the case in the U.S. at that time. In England, he was a rock star, had hundreds of thousands of people on Facebook, you know, followers and huge Twitter following. I think he's way over a million followers on Twitter right now. He's a very, very big deal in the U.K., and he's relatively unknown in the U.S., and certainly totally unknown in Canada. And we were discussing his kind of origin story from the amateurs fighting Mario Kindelin, where he lost out on a gold medal and then had a rematch with Kindelin that was much disputed, where he won UK judges, and that was the issue. But what I loved what he said was, I've made money. The spoils are nice. But it's about legacy. That's what I'm concerned with. I want my career to be remembered very fondly because of the guts that I demonstrated and who I fought and the way I fought. And I just remember thinking, like, that is exactly what this sport needs. I've always liked this guy's style. He's come back from getting knocked out by a relative nobody in brutal fashion in the first round. I think that took a lot of courage. He definitely... there seems to be some serious issues in regard to his chin, and yet he hasn't changed the way he fights, which is hyper-aggressive and risky. You know, he exposes himself to getting knocked out in an attempt to knock out opponents in extraordinary fashion. And now I'm seeing this kind of swagger where he's bragging about money. He bragged about his net worth in relation to Kell Brook. There's this shift that's happened as sort of a potentially great career has gone away as a result of these losses that he's had. And I don't take anything away from him for losing. He was very ambitious in the opponents that he matched himself up with, most notably with Canelo. But you see this overcompensation where now it is about business. And there's something snide about his attitude that seems to have emerged as he transitions into that I'm the A side, and he's disrespectful and kind of nasty to people that doesn't seem warranted. There just seems, I've seen photographs with him with his cars and even his new wife and stuff. It just seems like there's a different tenor to the way he wants to be viewed that seems like an overcompensation due to the fact that that career that he wanted has kind of gone away. And yeah, I don't know that it's very good for boxing that, I don't know, just the way that this has unraveled with Brook seems very disappointing, because I think Brook is a very exciting fighter, brave fighter. The Golovkin fight took a huge amount of balls to take. I don't really understand Khan's approach here.
it's almost as if, like, well, and the Brooke fight is such a natural, too. That's why it's particularly frustrating, is because that fight just makes itself. Like, that fight's there. They've already been talking shit to each other in the press for, like, a few years, and it's just there. Like, it makes no sense not to make it. But it's almost as if Amir Khan, like, at some point got way too disappointed with what he thought was going to happen with his career and then what actually happened. And I would guess that it probably had a lot to do with never landing a Floyd Mayweather or Manny Pacquiao fight, because for like probably two and a half years there, he sounded like he was dead on sure that he was going to get one of those fights. Like, there was no question. And I think that despite the fact that he's a really big star in the UK, and he is, because he's in like tabloids and stuff like that all the time, he doesn't really bring a big crowd over from the UK when he fights in the US, surprisingly. And I mean, I know that that like doesn't really make sense, because especially, you know, last week we were talking about that and the big crowds that often come over with UK fans and stuff like that. But I mean, really, like, the crowd numbers for a lot of his fights where he's not fighting someone else who's bringing in the crowd are just not good in the US. So for whatever reason, I think that it just was kind of like a kick to the shorts when he started kind of fighting over here more and more often and realized that he wasn't nearly a star on the level that he is in the UK. And I'm just speculating, but yeah, it's just really, that kind of turnaround is strange, because I can't really criticize him much in the ring. He takes risks, like you said. He fights in a way where, like, he shouldn't really be fighting pretty often, and he makes it work quite a bit, but you can't blame him for taking a risk and getting knocked out by somebody who's bigger or stronger, hits harder, or whatever. But still, it almost kind of didn't really turn out how it should have for him if you look at that amateur career, because that rematch, I don't know if you remember it at the time, but I do actually remember the rematch between Khan and Kindelan, and that was big boxing news in the UK at the time.
Mm-hmm. I agree with everything you said, and I think it was compounded by Mayweather holding that poll, didn't he? In order to see who the public wanted as his opponent. I believe Khan was the person who came up. And he still didn't go with him. That's right, isn't it?
Yes. Well, and it did almost seem kind of like Khan was getting baited a little bit. I don't know if it was intentional or if it wasn't, but it did kind of seem for a little bit there like he was going to get that fight. And it did seem like there were more people who wanted that fight than the fights that we actually got. I mean, you know, especially right around the time when Floyd fought Marcos Maidana. All respect to Maidana, who is a warrior and really fun to watch, but nobody really wanted or called for that fight when it happened. And then by accident, it wound up being good. And they were like, fuck it, let's run it back again. So, I mean, it's not really history gets remembered differently sometimes. But it seemed as if Amir Khan was going to get that fight.
Yeah, and I was always excited by the prospect of that fight, because I thought Khan arguably could match Floyd in hand speed. And then he just had length. Height and length and an aggression that we saw. I mean, one of the only times we saw some flaws in Floyd's defense was the hand speed of a 65-year-old Shane Mosley reaching him in the second round. And I thought Amir Khan, with his age, with his tenacity, aggressiveness, and a real offensive-minded fighter who likes to throw in combination, that maybe the third or fourth punch of combinations he'd be throwing Floyd's way, before Floyd had really measured Khan, could present some interesting results. And I think Amir had that sense as well, because, I mean, he, from what he told me, had quite comfortably handled Pacquiao in sparring sessions. So I was always disappointed that that didn't happen, and I always sort of blamed Floyd for some real hesitation. Now, I think it's intelligent on his part, because I think he recognized that he didn't have the physical dimensions to really dominate a fight like that. There would be some risk. And, yeah, I can see how it would be very frustrating to Amir. I just think you're seeing this kind of, unlike Floyd, Amir turning heel seems genuine. You know, like he, this pettiness and ostentatiousness about money and net worth, to me it just seems like the last gasp of an ego, you know, and Kell Brook definitely gave him his comeuppance by saying, like, excuse me, are we talking about the same guy? And showed a photo of Amir blinking up at the lights after he was flattened by Canelo. It was well played.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if you're going to compare their positions, they both went up and fought bigger guys and bigger punchers. And Kell Brook, I mean, it's not like he came out looking great, but he came out conscious.
He did, and I thought they both came out, you know, I respect both of them for taking on a big challenge. It just makes it even more perplexing why they wouldn't engage in fighting each other when they're of comparable size and, I think, abilities. I think it would be an amazing fight. I mean, I really, really like watching both these guys fight, and especially so when they fight, you know, quality opposition. It's these guys don't almost ever have boring fights. Even when they're fighting people you don't care about. But when they do fight people you care about, you know, Kell Brook went right at Golovkin. And if I think he was naturally Golovkin's size, I could easily have seen Golovkin go down from some of the uppercuts he took. He was there to be hit. And similarly, I thought Amir Khan put on a really impressive performance against Canelo. His boxing looked really impressive. But that chin is not going to take punches from a middleweight. I mean, it's not able to take punches from people two weight classes below if they're landed cleanly, for the most part. I mean, there are exceptions. And yet, to his credit, as long as he's conscious, that guy is not giving up. I thought he showed tremendous heart against Maidana. I mean, my God, that was a close call, what he survived there. So it's a shame that both guys that we're talking about them in terms of why they won't make the fight. And I don't mean to suggest that I think Kell Brook is being obstructionist here, because I think every indication is he really wants the fight. He just doesn't want to get lubed up and bent over by Khan.
And I don't blame him. I don't see why that fight wouldn't really be pretty darn close to about 50-50. I mean, I don't know all of the particulars, but it's a close fight. On paper, it's a close fight. You know, they're kind of in similar positions right now. It's, whatever. I don't know. But I hope it does wind up getting made, because that's just a natural, like I said. And seemingly the only reason why Khan survived that Maidana fight is because Joe Cortez is as bad a referee as he is. But that's a topic for another time.
True.
Or actually, I should say, as bad a referee as he was, because he retired and gave a weird speech at the Hall of Fame. But anyway, as it pertains to this weekend, bringing it back as far as the rematch talk and the ease with which this rematch was made, it really is refreshing, and it's nice that we are getting this kind of fight again. Although I will say, and I'm not trying to be negative or anything like that, but it does sometimes concern me when we get two fighters give everything that they have in a fight, and it winds up being a taxing fight, a fight that, you know, physically has to take something out of them. And then they wind up getting back in relatively soon after that grueling fight, and all signs point to them once again putting on a thrilling fight, because that's just their style. I think that kind of is sometimes concerning. And even though I don't want to bog down the show with negativity or anything like that, I say this constantly, but these kind of hard, these difficult thoughts, these kind of cognitive dissonance, you know, thoughts, they should be discussed, because when they don't, they get ignored and then bad things happen. Do you think that this will have an effect on them long term, or, you know, is this the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, we're what, 6 months I think their last fight was July 30th. So around 6 months.
Yeah.
I don't know. Getting punched in the head is not going to help long term. There's no question. So I mean, can we get a consensus on what's necessary to protect these guys? It's tricky. It's dangerous. And, you know, I don't even know if football there was the.
And also, and sorry to interrupt you, but.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, it also is a relevant discussion because when we got the fights in New York, you know, on social media, I saw a whole lot of complaining about how New York was handling fighters who were potentially hurt or they were assessing, you know, basically concussions and whatnot in ring and kind of delaying the action. And to me, it's like I kind of want a happy medium between safety and totally marring what the fight is. But at the same time, if we have to delay some shit for the fighter's safety, I mean, I don't really have a problem with that. And I guess I wasn't that surprised because boxing fans on social media are shitheads. But at the same time, it was kind of surprising to see so many people like moaning and wailing about this kind of stuff. And I'm like, what? They're trying to make sure the fighter's safe.
Yeah, it's a weird point, and I wonder why I feel like I'm standing over quicksand no matter what position I take with it, because I like exciting fights that produce a lot of action, and it's always thrilling to see guys, you know, like we saw with DeGale and Jack. We saw, a battered eardrum, you know, some serious injuries, you know, serious injuries that if a member of your family sustained this from a car accident, you know, you'd be scared, you know, to see them. You know, you'd feel terrible for several weeks having to, you know, check in on them about how they're recovering and stuff. And those relatives are likely not awaiting a rematch 6 months later, you know, where how much of this stuff gets fully healed, you know, like some of it doesn't. Some of the damage that's sustained in these things is, as I think the point you're making, is irreparable.
Yeah.
And almost every fight that fighters go into the ring, and I don't think people appreciate this, they're always going into the fight less than 100%. You know, if you're sparring, you're definitely getting worn down. You're definitely, if you've ever been to a world-class gym, if you go to Wild Card and you watch pros sparring, it is amazing to think that they're doing this for several weeks in the lead-up before a fight, and then fight like, you know, they stop sparring maybe a week before or a handful of days before, but they take punishment. You know, Pacquiao, for however many fights he's already had, I mean, tack on to that thousands of rounds sparring, and once he became a world champion, thousands of rounds sparring against world-class competition, big hitters trying to make a name for themselves in the gym and make a name for themselves in the industry by, I got the best of Pacquiao, you know, those kind of, that contributing to that kind of rumor mill so that they can get better contracts and be in a better position with trainers, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think this is true of a lot of the, you know, any contact sport, any football player, you're seeing them on Sunday, you're not seeing them for the rest of the week in terms of what kind of damage they've dealt with. And, you know, it's a big deal, and it's tough because people do want the action and they complain about fighters that are more technical. But there's a lot of risk. And there's a lot of stuff that we don't see, and almost every fighter that I've spent time with during profiles that has made points to me that they don't want to discuss their medical record. They'll discuss what aspects of their medical record they've disclosed, but they won't discuss their real medical record for the record because they're afraid of how it could jeopardize their future professionally.
And And, you know, there have been people who have put it a lot more poetic than this and who have worded it a lot better than this. But basically, when a fighter gets into a ring, he's already fought a number of times before in the lead up to that fight. It's already been, you know, a whole bunch of damage has already been done. And again, I don't want to, like, you know, just totally, you know, muck up this show with a bunch of negativity or, you know, sadness or anything like that. But anyway, like I said before, if boxing fans and, you know, media, I think, has a responsibility to talk about this kind of stuff. But boxing fans, too, I think that if you're going to be a fan of boxing and if you are going to encourage fighters to be ultra violent and you want that kind of, like, brawling, and if you want that, I think that you just at least have to be able to recognize what that means. That's it, you know, and respect that.
Yeah, it's just part of the game that the vast majority of the people who participate in this industry are going to come away, you know, like any blue collar worker. My grandfather was a logger. He lost a lot of friends who were killed. It's a very dangerous injury. He had a tree fall on his leg. He walked with a limp from the age of 26 to 96.
Yeah.
It you know, it's just the same, I think, in any of these industries. They are dangerous. It's why they make a little more money than minimum wage, because there's just real risk that these people accept to participate. And boxing is the same. You watch Facing Ali. Every fighter that was interviewed in that documentary spoke English, and I think over half of them required subtitles because of the slurring. And that's a very, very common sight with fighters over 50, certainly at 60, that the majority of them, their speech patterns have changed, have devolved. And often we're seeing even fighters, not often, but not uncommonly are we seeing fighters in their 40s who were once great fighters, who are slurring while they're fighting, which is a pretty big signifier. You would think that some neurological damage has been incurred, and you're just thinking, if the tests that they're running to clear these guys to fight are not picking up on what is obvious to any layman, if you do the comparative analysis, it kind of makes the question what the criterion is to allow these guys to fight. I mean, where do we say you can't do this anymore? I don't know what that answer is. That's a very tricky subject to parse, but definitely there are issues there that are for smarter, better people than me to figure it out.
It's a tough one. There's no question. I can't remember where exactly he got it from, or if perhaps he came up with it, but I've been reading William Detloff's book about Ezard Charles, and I could have sworn that I've heard this phrase before, but he says, more or less, he breaks it down to, do you want safe boxing or do you want boxing? Because safe boxing doesn't really exist. And so you kind of have to just accept what it is and what comes with it. And either you do or you don't. And that's, I guess, kind of where we are. But nonetheless, I mean, we have a real fun series of fights coming up this weekend. And like we've been discussing, I think this Frampton-Santa Cruz fight probably will be the most competitive, probably will be the most action-packed. And anyway, if we just keep what we were talking about in the back of our minds as that's happening, maybe we'll have a better respect for everything that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it is. It's just an element of it, you know? Like, I don't know that it's that different in a lot of ways. Where I went to high school, our entire PE department was filled with ex-rugby players who played at a national and international level. All of them walked with great difficulty. Like, if you're a professional athlete, the wear and tear on your body is enormous. So it's just part of what I think makes you appreciate what they do and the sacrifice involved that much more. You know, it's part of the drama, you know. And these guys are not drafted. They're elect to do what they do. So I don't know. It's just part of it, and I agree. Like, there's some great fights ahead. I have a real feeling like I just signed on to do a big article sort of contrasting the UK fervor with boxing and how their amateur program and you know, as a country, how they support boxing paired to where we're at in the United States right now. And I'm excited to sort of delve into that, to sort of look at how attitudes have changed and how boxing has a purchase on a society, you know, the respective societies, the UK and the US. And I think there's just the big genesis of that, or impetus rather for that for me, was just that 90,000 people in the UK want to see Klitschko Joshua, a fight that is potentially like an era transitioning heavyweight champion. Is really interesting. It's been a while since we've had a heavyweight championship fight that has really had some real attention. And I don't know what exactly is going on with the UK in terms of just how boxing is so big that it can sell out stadiums when they have a fraction of the population the US does. And I don't know that, you know, even Pacquiao Mayweather, I don't know if it would have sold out Cowboy Stadium, probably, but this fight is nowhere near that in terms of its relevance or, in terms of transcending boxing or even sport. But I get the feeling that Con Brook could sell out a stadium in the UK of 70,000, 80,000 people. So I'm kicking myself that I'm not able to see what that looks like, because the times I've watched boxing in Ireland with Rigondeaux, I've never seen fans more intense. So I imagine 90,000 of them. I mean, Rigo Willie Casey was like 4,000 people, and it was probably the craziest crowd I've ever seen for boxing.
It really is amazing. It's bucket list stuff for sure. But man, as soon as I can, I swear, as soon as I can, I want to do that. But so we kind of talked last week about the Barclays crowd for the Badu Jack versus James DeGale fight, and they, well, they being Carl Frampton and Leo Santa Cruz, they fought at Barclays the last time. Not sure if you saw that live, but nonetheless, they're going to be fighting at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas this time. So, I mean, sometimes I just don't even really understand what goes into choosing a venue or a city or whatever for fights these days. Because at this point, Vegas is almost like a dead city for fights. I just feel like people don't really give a shit about fights going to Vegas anymore. Am I wrong about that?
I'm the wrong one to ask, because I just despise that city. And I've never really liked any fights that I've seen in Las Vegas. I don't feel that. I mean, I'm not trying to disparage the West Coast for putting on fights, because I think the StubHub Center might be the most exciting place I've ever watched fights. California puts on some great stuff. L.A. puts on some good fights, too, at the Staples Center. Nothing can match the StubHub Center. I've never seen anything like that in the United States. The fans, the action, outdoor, it's just, it's very almost sort of dreamlike. Like, it's a real, like, if you have a chance to see a fight there, especially a good fight.
Tough to beat.
It'd be really fun.
It's pretty tough to beat. And I've seen a number of live fights there, and a number of really good live fights there. I saw, you know, Israel Vasquez lit the joint up a number of different times, namely against Marquez the third time. Great, great fight. You know, Maidana Soto Caras, Rios Alvarado won. I mean, so I've seen like almost half of the really, really good fights that I've seen in the time that I've been a boxing fan have been at that venue. I have no idea what it is, but I'll take it. But I mean, it just seems that, like, the West Coast is, I have no issue with that or anything like that, even though Portland and the surrounding areas has, like, no boxing to speak of, which sucks. But nonetheless, you know, L.A. is still great. for fights. It still has just some ridiculous sparring. It's considered a hub for West Coast boxing. There's no question. But at the same time, I just feel like Las Vegas has kind of been burned out. I used to love going to Vegas for fights, and now it's just kind of like the thought of even doing that is like turns my stomach.
Yeah, I haven't enjoyed it myself. I've been burned every time. I think the first fight I went to in Las Vegas was Roy Jones Bernard Hopkins 2, which far and away is the worst fight I've ever seen live. I don't know what the hell was happening in the fight. Pacquiao Mayweather most recently, which obviously was just a barn burner. I just don't enjoy it as a fight town. All people talk about is the money associated with it. You know, the cost of tickets or how much the fighters are getting. It's not really a fight town for boxing people. It's a fight town for people that are very much just parachuting in for one event, mainly to be seen. It's sort of a Instagram crowd more than it's who are into it. And StubHub Center just, it's the polar opposite. It very much is, perhaps it's I find the StubHub Center has a much larger Latino community that's just to support fights, and they're just the funnest people to watch fights with. I guess mainly it's a Mexican crowd. Puerto Rican crowd in New York is always phenomenal to watch fights with, but there's nothing quite like that Mexican crowd supporting somebody from their country. It just makes for, you can feel like the fighters fight differently as a result of the crowd, and that's just rare. I don't feel that very much even in New York, that the crowd changes the way the fighters fight.
Hey, Bryn, I'm pretty sure we're doing the, like, echo or, like, delay thing again. I was just going to say real quick what I'll do, if it's cool with you, is I'll, like, hang up on you and call you back. Is that cool?
Sure. The echo thing is profound.
Okay. Okay. All right. Hang tight. And I will now call that son of a bitch back. There we go.
Hey. Any improvement on the echo? I'm not sure yet.
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
I'm not sure yet. Oh, shit. I think it is still delaying a little bit. It's still delaying just by a little bit, I think, but whatever. Anyway, what you were talking about with Mexican fans is pretty much goes without saying. It's just kind of one of those stereotypes in boxing that rings true, but is a good thing. And hopefully that actually kind of winds up playing out a little bit this weekend, because in Vegas, that's pretty much the only thing that you can count on unless it's a huge fight. And you get a whole lot of, Ricky Hatton fans there for a Floyd Mayweather fight. Beyond that, you really are hoping for Southern California fans.
Yeah, no. I think it's going to do very well, by kind of all metrics. I just, maybe somehow it leads to a trilogy on top of that. So I'm really interested to see how it will play out. And I was curious to ask you about the recent press conference with Angel Garcia, what you thought of that performance.
Oh, man. I think I don't really want to get very political or anything like that, but at the same time, I think that this does kind of fall a little bit under that umbrella, and Jesus. It's complicated, I think. And I know a lot of people are going to say, no, it's not complicated. Either you do this one thing or you don't do this one thing. And namely, that would be saying the N-word, basically. I think that promoting a fight is one thing. And I'm fine with people promoting a fight and being outrageous to promote a fight and kind of being outlandish or saying jerky things or whatever. I'm okay with that. But there are obviously certain lines that probably shouldn't be crossed. And getting nasty, like getting malicious, I think more often than not is not necessary. And that's going beyond just promoting a fight. That's being nasty. And I think that's what Angel Garcia frequently does, is he acts like a nasty fucking jerk. And in this case, I think that if you were going after the part of it where he was using the N-word, on one hand, I do know that especially in New York, in Philly, in like around that area, Puerto Ricans using that word is exceedingly common. For better or for worse, whether you agree or not, it's really common. That's not something that you would hear, for instance, like just for a point, kind of a point of comparison, you would not generally hear a bunch of West Coast Mexican dudes saying that word. But yeah, for whatever reason, it's kind of been accepted into like the lexicon, the Puerto Rican lexicon on the East Coast. So it's not really uncommon, and not saying I agree with it, it just is there. But at the same time, he was also saying it in a way where he was kind of using it like it was an epithet. He wasn't saying it just kind of like casually in conversation, dropping it in there. He was like yelling it at Keith Thurman. So I have a tough time saying it's okay. Do I think he should be like reprimanded? Do I think that they should like tear the whole production down? And no, but at the same time, it should be called out, should be recognized, and people should be like, dude, you should shut your ass up.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely can say anecdotally, like, being like 5 years living in Spanish Harlem, which is predominantly Dominican, but there's still a pretty large contingent of Puerto Ricans who live here and certainly are, you know, passing through. It is. It's not uncommon for me to hear it, but I think that there would be an issue with a white Puerto Rican using that term towards a darker, you know, somebody who clearly has black blood. There's just something there that just felt off, that didn't just feel like acceptable conduct. And I feel uncomfortable with all that kind of stuff. I mean, what do I know as a guy of European descent, like to speak to the issue, but I agree with you that I felt very much the way that he was using it was an epithet used to taunt somebody who was of darker skin than he was. And I don't see in any way where you could argue that that was culturally acceptable and that we on the outside are interpreting it wrongly. I think it was very much using race to go at him. We've never heard him use that term, towards anybody before that I'm aware of. I've never seen Angel Garcia or Danny throw that term out there casually. It seemed very specific to this dynamic, and not just to shock the crowd who was there in Brooklyn, but to try to use race to get at somebody who is darker skinned than Angel Garcia. And I just think it's utterly deplorable. I would take a harsher stance than you because I think the optics of seeing Lou DiBella laughing as it's happening, and I would say he's laughing because he supported it, but I think he allowed that to continue 4 or 5 times, I believe Garcia used the term. And to see Lou DiBella, you know, hours later go on social media and say it's not acceptable. But the image that people saw, if you watch the video, Lou is kind of giggling and then he gets up there and said, clearly these guys don't like each other, as if it's just a means of assisting the promotion. And if that's the level that you need to stoop to assist the promotion, and by the way, I don't think it does assist the promotion. I think far and away the message takeaway of that press conference was, what a sport we have where this is permissible, where this is okay, and Angel Garcia believes that this is acceptable, is terrifying. I mean, it makes boxing just look like a joke. And I think that these guys, if they want the respectability, because they're always talking about how much, you know, boxing is discussed in the context of being a fringe sport or whatever, but my God, like the lack of professionalism, I don't know that boxing needs to be a league and everybody needs to be sanctioned or whatever, but just a level of etiquette and decorum and respect. I mean, respect is one of the things that I love about boxing, the industry, is I think most of the people are really good people, but in turn, I think that people do need to take this seriously, because this, even a lot of Puerto Ricans I know who wrote to me afterwards just saying that this made them feel really, really awful about the sport. And it made them feel embarrassed as Puerto Ricans that this gives them a really bad name, to think that this is culturally acceptable behavior.
Well, and I'm also happy that you and I both kind of at least have some kind of, you know, introspection or self-awareness to know that we're two white dudes sitting here talking about whether or not other people are allowed to use the N-word at other. I mean, it's just, it's rich. It's very rich. But at the same time, I've seen a lot of people in the wake of that happening say, oh, well, you know, boxing needs characters like that. No, boxing needs characters, but doesn't need characters like that. It has a whole lot of characters as is. And that's one of the great things about boxing, and something that I hope never changes. But at the same time, like, we don't specifically need characters like that. We don't need characters who are saying racist shit. We need, I think that especially at this point, if anybody ever expects boxing to be anything remotely approaching mainstream or safe to like, or for even for us people who write about the sport to not be like embarrassed when people ask what we do. And we're like, what do you do outside of here? What do you do away from work? And I'm like, oh, I write about boxing. They're like, you write what? You write about what? I mean, if we could even get to a point where that's not the case, we probably could use more decorum than less.
Yeah, and I think even, you know, it makes it embarrassing. I've been teaching boxing in New York now for going on seven years in Central Park, and going to people's apartments to train. Sometimes the parents of kids hire me to work with them, and the misconceptions that abound about boxing and the character of people who participate in this sport, it's really pleasing to me to offer another side of it, which is the reality of participating in it, is that there is honor and respect and dignity, and more than anything, when you learn how to fight, going through the motions, is that it instills a real sense of not wanting to exert violence against anybody. It makes you want to protect yourself, first of all. You feel safe in the world, and people who feel safe in the world are not very violent. You know, it's hurt or insecure people that want to go hurt other people. And something like this bothers me because, like, every week I work with some kids who are, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old, and to be, as you're saying, to be associated with the sport as somebody who writes about it and writes about some of the most famous people that I'm fortunate to spend time with, I think it tars all of us to be associated with it. So I'm not trying to speak on the racial dynamics of, you know, like what lexicon is appropriate, but all I'm saying is the optics of seeing a lighter skinned person hurling epithet after epithet against a darker skinned person to a crowd of people that in some ways are, I don't know if they're encouraging it. I think some of their behavior tacitly encouraged it. Like I'm describing Lou DiBella, I don't think he knew how to deal with it. And I think it's time that we say people do need to know how to deal with this, because just letting it happen again and again and again, and then broadcasting it on television, and then it gets on YouTube, like people, we look like clowns to, and we're in a time right now, like, again, not to go political, but we're in a time where we need to call this shit out. Like, this stuff is not appropriate. Like, this stuff
does harm. It does damage. And if we see that it's acceptable on television, kids are going to imitate it. You know, they're going to think it's cool because it's, they're going to assume that this is being a character, is using a term like this that pushes buttons. And it's not being a character. This is the lowest common denominator of just, you know, monkeys hurling shit from a cage at people. Like, there's nothing to this. This is the biggest cowardly way to attack somebody. You know, it's the least intelligent, creative way to attack somebody, is just to go after them. I mean, it's Donald Trump making fun of somebody who's disabled. You know, it's wheelchair jokes or throwing rocks at somebody who has a mental disability. So, I'm not suggesting that whatever race somebody is a disability, but I'm just saying using it against them is just, to me, such a despicable action.
Well, yeah, using something that somebody can't control, something that, you know, someone was born with, basically. No, I agree. And I don't mean to say, like, you know, we shouldn't be having this conversation. I just mean that, you know, it's more just ironic that we are, in a way. But nonetheless, you know, I agree. And I think that that's also what these people are in place for. That's what these, you know, PR people are in place for. That's what, and by PR, I don't mean Puerto Rican, but that's what these public relations people are in place for. That's what these promoters are there for. They're supposed to know what to say. Not that it has to be scripted, but they should know what the cutoff is. You know, they should know what's safe to say, what's not safe to say, what's kosher, what's not kosher. But it went well beyond promoting the fight, and that's kind of the point, is that this is totally unnecessary. And you can contrast that and bring it right back to where we were, to Frampton and Santa Cruz, where, like, the most controversial thing that either one of them says in the lead up is, "I'm going to knock that guy out," and people are like, "Damn, it's a huge contrast."
Yeah, and let's remember also that it wasn't just racial. I mean, it was also homophobic, and I think there was one other trope that Angel Garcia had in there as well. Was there another one? It wasn't just race and homophobic. Wasn't there something misogynistic on top of it? Calling him like a bitch or a whore or something, or somebody else associated with him?
Yeah, not to at all excuse it or anything like that, but I will say that it is really common, especially among, you know, boxing fans and on social media and everything, for, you know, to say homophobic shit, to call each other bitch, you know, stuff like that. That's really common. But I think he said bitch. I don't remember for sure, but regardless, the point is that, like, pretty much all around, he touched on a few separate, you know, points of disparagement and, you know, disrespect there.
And what was, explain to me, because I didn't get it the first couple times I was watching it, but he underlines the whole tirade with Trump, 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 or something close to that. What did that even mean? Like, I didn't understand what is that as a summation? I don't get it.
I really don't even know. I mean, that guy, you know, like I was kind of saying before, I'm cool with characters in boxing. I like characters in boxing. Boxing should have characters. Some of the greatest characters in sports of all time have been in boxing. But I don't really understand him. And I don't really understand the fascination with him that a lot of boxing fans have. And not just him, but there are also other kind of people or characters like him in boxing that are kind of, like, controversial to the point of being, like, jerks constantly. And that kind of seems to be their aim. And I'm just not into that. I have no interest in that. And I don't understand, like, to me, it's very similar to, like, the Floyd Mayweather 24/7 kind of thing, where people just love it and they eat it up, and I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's done
if it's done creatively, you know, like the Sacha Baron Cohen stuff with Bruno and Borat, you know, xenophobia, homophobia, definitely bringing in a lot of racism. that is an interesting take, you know, where we start exploring this kind of stuff. But I mean, I'm not trying to suggest here that I think Angel Garcia had some overriding point that's of real significance for us to ponder. I mean, there's not much going on with this guy aside from the fact that at best he's trying to promote a fight, and least of all, he's just a really insecure guy who's never accomplished anything beyond on the coattails of his son. And I've respected his son as a fighter for taking on some very difficult fights, from doing very well. But this weird puppet show that the two of them have, where Danny has deniability by virtue of his father being this bad cop promoting fights, it's just, it's getting tired and stale. And I always found it just repellent to begin with. I mean, he just seems like, as you say, just like a complete rank asshole. And I think Danny should do something about it. I think it, Danny's name gets dragged through the mud for it. You know, at the best, he's complacent about what his dad is doing. And it's just embarrassing more than anything.
It really is embarrassing. And I kind of almost feel bad for Danny in a way for it, because you know, that is a tough spot to be in, because that is your dad. And there is history there where, like, they do have a kind of closeness, and there is some, you know, shit that went on in their past that makes them close and whatnot. And so I do kind of feel bad for him. It's not like I would expect him to just totally disown his father or to go start talking shit about his father or anything like that for stuff he said. But at the same time, I mean, it's really just, it's not a good look. To not immediately turn around and be like, you know, he says what he says, and I'm just going to disagree. That would kind of be a minimum, I would think. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just we've just seen this happen so many times, and he just gets more emboldened, like we saw at this press conference, to go in directions that definitely taint the reputation of the sport. And as I say, like, I was struck that very, very rarely do I have people, you know, acquaintances contact me just to say, this was disgusting, because they have such a low regard in terms of the discourse about promoting fights in the first place that nothing really surprises them. But this definitely surprised them. As I say, the optics of a lighter-skinned person calling out somebody darker, using that epithet, it's not doing anybody any favors. I don't think it did the fight any favors, and I don't think it does the sport any favors.
At best, it makes people pissed off at this guy and hope he gets knocked out, and then, you know, brings a couple of extra eyes to it for that specific, you know, reason. But beyond that, I don't really think it did much. I don't. But kind of bringing us again back into what we were talking about, one of the fights I didn't want to get away from us, and I did want to bring up, was Mikey comeback, and he's fighting Dejan Zlatichanin. He's a fighter from Montenegro that kind of popped up in the last 2 to 2.5 years. I mean, he's didn't come totally from out of nowhere, but nonetheless, he's kind of risen to prominence in that time, and is a pretty exciting fighter, an effective fighter, and one that I think a lot of people are, I don't want to say scared for Mikey Garcia, that's not the case, but I think are really seeing this as a challenge for Mikey Garcia, who had a lot easier time with some other fighters at lower weights before he took about 2 years off. I don't know the full story about why Mikey Garcia decided to, you know, basically take 2 years off. I know he was going to be a police officer for a while, and then there were promotional issues and blah, blah, blah. But he's still considered a very, very good fighter, 35-0. I think probably the closest really that he came to losing was against Orlando Salido, and where many people felt that he kind of bowed out of the fight early and, you know, didn't need to. And if that's the closest that they got, still undefeated, still there. And I think this is also a really good fight this weekend. It's kind of going under the radar considering what the other fights are, though.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a good fight, and I think you're talking about characters in the sport. I think one of the things I respect about Mikey Garcia is, apart from what he's done on, you know, outside of the ring to hinder his development as a fighter, I think he made himself a character in boxing by his style, and you know, he seemed like a very dangerous fighter that was on the brink of fighting some big names. And if he could clear the way, you know, through them, he could be, you know, a pound-for-pound top five caliber fighter. So I think that's the way in which he created his own character in the sport. And I think it was disappointing to see the way his career has gone. And what's that stupid Dan Rafael term, the Winky Wright School, business school of boxing. Definitely Mikey Garcia seemed to go in that direction with, you know, promotional issues with Bob Arum and company. So I hope he can turn it around because he's a big time talent. I've been to several of his fights and I'm a fan, and I'd love to see him square off against some of the people. You know, he was going to fight Gamboa earlier on. I thought that would have been an incredible fight. I don't even know who I would favor in that contest.
That, well, at this point, I think Gamboa is just kind of, his ship has sailed, unfortunately. I don't know what the heck happened to that dude, but he pretty much, you know, flew the coop as far as I'm concerned. But even when Mikey Garcia was out, he's only 29, by the way. He took a solid 2 years off, and he's still only 29. And even when he was out and when he wasn't around, he was the kind of fighter that people were saying, where is that guy? What happened to him? Where is he? We need to see him back in the sport. Very effective fighter, fairly exciting fighter too. Yeah, it was kind of disappointing to see him kind of almost sabotage his own career, like kind of as you were hinting at. I don't know that I would use the same Winky Wright, whatever, but I have to admit that's kind of funny. But still, it's good to see him back, and it's good to see him back and serious about taking on serious opponents as well. He's not just kind of taking the easy road. He's taking on a guy who we don't know a ton about because he's only been on U.S. television, I think, twice. But in those two appearances, he's been a kind of scary-looking fighter and a fighter who looks very dangerous. So this is a dangerous fight, and for us to be getting this is an opener to Frampton-Santa Cruz rematch. That's big.
Yeah, I totally agree. And going back to your point, actually – I read that Uriorkis Gamboa was just picked up by Golden Boy. So for a 35-year-old with only one loss, I wonder if they're going to try to push him hard, you know, to get some big fights, you know, get what they can out of him before he's spent. That style definitely doesn't age well. So there's some interesting career resurgence there with that move by De La Hoya. But I totally agree with you with Garcia. I think Garcia loves to fight. He's extraordinarily well-schooled, always seems to come in to fights in great shape. So I hope he can make up for lost time, and we can see, you know, in the next couple of years that he can sort of take on the big names that are out there. It seems like he's got a lot of confidence in terms of moving around in weight classes to accommodate who he'd fight. So, I mean, he's another guy that I'd love to see him fight Lomachenko. I would really, really be interested to see how that would go, because Garcia is just such a dangerous
well-schooled fighter. You know, I think it's hard to imagine anybody walking through him, even the top people like Lomachenko.
He's a fighter that definitely can fall back on the technique and on the skill when other things start to erode, because he is fairly textbook with a lot of the stuff that he does. And not that being textbook is necessarily the aim or the best thing, but still, like I said, when other things start to erode, he still has the skills to fall back on, almost like a Bernard Hopkins type. Not trying to get too far into a comparison like that. But the point is that Mikey Garcia is a fighter I could see coming back and doing okay, whereas Yuriorkis Gamboa, I still have to kind of see what he's got, because I really don't know. He fought last in December of 2015, and from what I can tell, he's slated to be fighting on the undercard of the Lemieux-Curtis Stevens fight that was just recently announced for Turning Stone in March. And if that's true, if they have Yuriorkis Gamboa on the undercard of Lemieux versus Stevens, that's already turning out to be probably a fairly explosive card, even though it's perhaps not the height of elite boxing skill and world-class boxing. Nonetheless, that would be a very fun card to attend, I would imagine. And I am interested to see what happens to Gamboa, but speaking of people who kind of sabotage their own careers, man, he really sabotaged the shit out of his. It's really unfortunate. If he's able to get back into contention at or around lightweight, that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Gamboa had the best adjustment, shall we say, to American life. I think I don't know, as far as his character, Rigan Diao definitely is somebody that's not the most approachable, but I don't think he's a bad guy. I don't think there's a menace to him. I think he's a private person and probably pretty shy. Gamboa kind of seems like the other extreme. I think there is a darker kind of streak to the people that he wants to associate with, and like Mike Tyson after Don King, there was just a very different vibe to him. And Gamboa, I think, as you know, he's gotten a lot older, and then suffering the loss to Crawford, which was I thought a really exciting fight to watch. He did well early on, but Crawford was the superior fighter. I think he's struggling to come to grips with who he is, without being the dominant force who was on the verge of becoming like a really, really big name. I mean, one of the things Gamboa did when Peter Nelson took over HBO, I was listening to Nelson say this on Chris Mannix's podcast, was like sign on for a big fight and then just walk away and just not show up at two press conferences that he demanded there be, I think in LA and Miami, and stood up everybody at both of them. Which was something that Bob Arum in his early 80s said was the first time that it ever happened to him. Those aren't the kind of ways you want to stand out as a professional in the sport, that you're demanding things and then not showing up. There was a lot of marketability there with a distinctly un-Cuban style. I don't know. I hope he can turn it around, because I'm a big fan of him as a fighter, but as a person, I have my doubts. I was just watching a big gym brawl video that he was involved with. I'm not sure when it was filmed, but seems like there's some real instability with him as a person, and all the allegations of PEDs on top of that.
Well, yeah, and I think that it was that he was associated with and it was like an anti-aging clinic or something like that in Miami that wound up getting busted, and he was on the client list or something along those lines. And I mean, you know, considering his style, considering his physique, especially a couple of years ago, I guess it wouldn't be that surprising per se, but yeah, man, just went downhill pretty quickly, and that Rios fight imploding was just ugh, man, because that was easily at that time one of the better fights to be made in boxing, or one of the most explosive fights to be made in boxing. And for that to just kind of get kicked in the balls like that, it was just ugh, yuck. One of the crappier things to happen for sure. But yeah, if Gamboa is able to get back into contention at lightweight, great. I would love to see him against somebody like a Zlatichanin versus Garcia winner or something like that. I have no idea what his status is as far as what networks he's, you know, more or less allowed to fight on and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I have to say, this Showtime card, though, this weekend, it's a really, really strong showing. I mean, already in January, PBC and the PBC-associated fighters are really coming out the gate pretty hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with what you say with Gamboa. I mean, that Rios fight, I really like him in that fight to put on a very, very impressive performance that could have launched him to the pound-for-pound elite, and not just pound for pound supremacy, but I mean, just the guy had just such an electrifying style. So talk about just shitting the bed with your career. I mean, it was just, oh, such a waste. So, I mean, what are the big fights in the next 6 months that really have your attention? I'm curious.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to another rematch between Jorge Linares and Anthony Crawla. That's going to be in March. I'm really looking forward to that because that's a pretty fun fight, I think. The first one, obviously, was really fun, and I think this one is, again, Linares is just a guy who's vulnerable to the point of being exciting pretty much any time someone with any sort of punching power can reach him. So that's what I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to Golovkin versus Jacobs because I do think that there's a legitimate chance that Golovkin gets seriously challenged by Danny Jacobs' punching power. And on top of that, Roman Gonzalez, I think, is going to be fighting on the undercard, on the pay-per-view undercard or something like that. I know they've been talking about that. I mean, I'm not as sour toward the Canelo-Chavez Jr. matchup as most people are, because I think the matchup itself is probably going to be pretty fun, but that's not really something that I'm really heavily anticipating per se. It's just kind of, if that's what we get, I'm open to it. But I actually am, you brought it up earlier, Anthony Joshua versus Vladimir Klitschko. I'm looking forward to that fight for the potential of it, you know, being a kind of passing of the torch moment, or for Vladimir Klitschko to just kind of, you know, rediscover himself, I guess, and be able to shut down the young, likely, you know, heir apparent or whatever. And also on top of that, I'm looking forward to that event because seeing 90 people at a boxing event is just anytime something like that happens. And again, we talked about this last week, but that size event is just, it's crazy and it's awesome. It's a really awesome sight to see that many people in an arena or in a whatever, in a stadium, cheering on boxing. It's really just a reminder of what the sport once was, what it is now, and what it could be. And that's exciting. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Golovkin Jacobs will be, for however long it lasts, a really exciting fight. And I agree with you. I think Jacobs could give him, you know, I think Jacobs can punch. And I loved his audacity with what he did with Kid Chocolate, an undefeated fighter, just to go in there. I was at that fight and just stop him, you know, in the first minute or so. So I think he has to realize, and his trainers have to realize, that, you know, before Golovkin has really measured him, that his best opportunity is going to be to come out swinging, and preferably to come out swinging when Golovkin isn't, doesn't know have a good sense of sort of what the offensive arsenal is, hasn't, you know, measured him sufficiently. So it should lead up to a very exciting fight. It seems like Jacobs just doesn't like to go backwards. He likes to come forwards, and I think Golovkin is there to be hit. I think somebody is going to come along who, you know, packs a 160-pound punch that I just don't know how long Golovkin can take shots like that flush. I mean, he took it from Kell Brook, but there's going to be much bigger guys who are going to be able to land who are a lot stronger. Obviously, he's shown a good chin. So I'm excited about that, and I agree with you. I think Joshua Klitschko could be a very, very big deal, and I don't necessarily think that Joshua wins that fight very easily. I'm almost tempted to favor Klitschko in it. I think Klitschko does not want to sort of get the crown, and so maybe that leads to a very, very dramatic fight between just two massive guys, and you've got age and youth, and in some ways maybe it's a little similar to sort of Lennox Lewis and Vitaly Klitschko, which maybe was my favorite heavyweight fight in the last 10-15 years. I just thought there was so much drama associated with that fight. I wonder if something similar could happen here. So those are the two big ones for me.
Yeah, those are – I don't want to get overly optimistic because a whole lot of stuff can happen between now and when the fights really start going down. But at the same time, there's no question that 2017 is already looking to be a whole different animal than 2016. And I guess it pretty much all started with that Badou-Jack versus James DeGale fight. So it's pretty much continuing on, thank goodness. I'm happy that it's kind of, you know, going in this direction, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And one of the things that I hope continues more in 2017 is another fight that's on the schedule that I am looking forward to, but just kind of I for whatever reason I'm seeing it as being as having more spoiler potential than and by spoiler I mean kind of like, you know, not very good fight. I have it seeing as that kind of potential for whatever reason, and that's the Danny Garcia versus Thurman fight. For whatever reason, I just I can't really get super excited about it, even though I know that it's a top world-class matchup. It's probably going to be a good fight as far as like a, you know, being a world-class fight. And on top of that, it's two guys from the same stable who – you know, going by the recent formula, shouldn't be fighting each other or wouldn't be fighting each other and are. But for whatever reason, I'm just kind of – I have a tough time being really excited for the matchup itself.
I'm excited because I just think Thurman – I had lunch with Thomas Hauser the other day, and he mentioned that he followed Thurman from the – press conference when we were discussing with Angel Garcia back to the airport, and they ended up having 2 hours together where after talking on the way to the airport, Thurman actually said to the driver, could you pull over so we can just finish this conversation? And they stayed there for another 45 minutes or so. And Hauser was really blown away by how intriguing a character that Thurman was, which was not really on my radar. So I'm a lot more intrigued by this matchup by virtue of Hauser talking about the intricacies of what's going on inside Thurman's mind going into this fight, you know, which is a real opportunity for him to make a name for himself, a bigger name for himself in the sport. He's certainly got all the qualities that should lead him to become a very popular, exciting fighter going forward against bigger and bigger names. So I have more optimism about that fight than I think you do.
Well, there's always the possibility that Keith Thurman plays somebody some flute or some ocarina or something like that before or after the fight. So I have to admit, there's a little bit of excitement about that part of it. And also, there's the possibility that he could have the bong resin that's stuck up in his head knocked loose. He does seem like he's a goofball. I like Keith Thurman. He seems like a dude I would like to hang out with.
Well, and maybe we get like a twofer that after he knocks out Dan Garcia, his father jumps into the ring, and we get a kind of WWF style knocking out the father and son as like a bonus.
That would be best case scenario. That would definitely be best case scenario. No, I do think that it's not a bad fight or anything like that. I don't think it'll be bad. I'm just not I'm not super into it, and you know, nothing wrong with not being super into a fight. But I brought him up last week, and we kind of like briefly talked about it, just basically, you know, kind of as a preamble to this week, but this week's show, that is. And I brought up Francisco Vargas, and I mentioned him as, without a doubt, being one of the most exciting fighters in boxing. I'll repeat that. He's one of the most exciting fighters in boxing. You know, Francisco Vargas wound up, most recently, he wound up putting on a show against Orlando Salido in June of last year. But then in November of 2015, he had a thrilling fight with Takashi Miura, who's fighting on this HBO undercard of Francisco Vargas versus Miguel Burchelt. I'm not really 100% sure what that crowd's going to be like out in Fantasy Springs Casino Indio, but at least in Southern California, putting two Mexicans against each other and two Mexicans who, you know, are going to come to fight in that main event between Vargas and Burchelt, it certainly doesn't have the name value of a Frampton, Santa Cruz, or, you know, maybe not even really a Mikey Garcia at this stage, but still, I have to emphasize, anybody who is listening in, I highly doubt it at this point that anybody who is not a hardcore boxing fan would be listening to this show. If you're a hardcore boxing fan, you know, if you're listening in, you're a hardcore boxing fan, know about the fight, and we'll probably be watching it anyway. But just in case you were thinking about not watching it, or in case you're listening in and you're not a hardcore fan and you're thinking, who are these two guys, tune in if Francisco Vargas is fighting. Because the dude is all balls and comes to fight and is skilled, puts on a good performance. And I think that this is pretty much guaranteed to be thrilling for however long it lasts.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I hesitate to say he's like one of my number one prospects for the future because he's 32 years old, but he is a very, very exciting fighter. Dramatic, just has that X quality, you know, a couple of draws, but otherwise undefeated, knocks out most of his opponents. And I think there's going to be, you know, a growing fan base behind him as more people get to see this guy fight. So I totally agree with you. He's a very, very exciting fighter with hopefully a lot bigger fights, you know, against name opponents to come in the future.
And like you said, it's difficult to kind of get excited for him as a prospect or as somebody who's going to be around for a real long time because of, one, his age, he's 32, but two, that style and that kind of fighting. You know, you get into those kinds of fights frequently. I can't imagine those types of fighters lasting very long in the sport, and that's unfortunate, but at least while he's around, I'll be paying attention. I promise that. And the guy that I was just mentioning him that he had fought, Takashi Miura, is fighting Mickey Roman on in like the co-feature, undercard, whatever you want to refer to it as. And Miura is another guy who comes to fight, hits hard, and is probably going to put on some kind of show. But it's just it's, I guess, just kind of a question of how much he has left and how much you know, he's not a super young guy himself at 32 and has been through a lot more in the pro ranks than a Francisco Vargas. And I guess it's just kind of a question of how much that Vargas fight took out of him and how much the previous fights took out of him. But nonetheless, he's fighting a far less polished guy in Miguel Roman, Mickey Roman, on the undercard, and that should be pretty fun too. I'm not really 100% sure which one of these cards, I guess, I would absolutely have to tune into if I had to choose one live, but kind of leaning Showtime, but I'm not gonna blame anybody for choosing the HBO one either.
Yeah, no. But I mean, like you're saying, it portends good things for 2017, where we're struggling about which network to watch on a Saturday night. So it speaks well of boxing getting its act together a little bit this year.
Well, and I know that often there's a complaint, and it's a valid complaint, that when there are competing cards on the same night, you know, it kind of hurts both cards because then people are forced to choose. And I understand that. I do think that that's a valid argument. That is true in a sense that, like, you know, there would be more people watching if just one of these cards were happening this Saturday night and then another, you know, the HBO card were happening the following Saturday. That's true. But at the same time, you know, kind of like how you're hinting at, this is not the worst problem to have. Like, too much competition among the, you know, in the boxing schedule, that's not an awful problem to have. And yes, hopefully suggests good things for the rest of 2017. But so I guess my question for you is, we were talking a couple weeks ago about the heavyweight thing. We were just talking about Klitschko, Joshua, etc. And I mean, it's a fun subject to talk about, and it's a relevant subject to talk about because the heavyweight division is kind of on the rise right now. But Deontay Wilder's opponent, who I'm probably going to really struggle to pronounce if I try, but a Polish dude. I think it was Rorschach, I guess. Rorschach. He tested positive for some banned substance, and that fight wound up getting scrapped, and he's now going to be fighting somebody else. We have no idea who on February 25th. So, where is heavyweight boxing in the U.S.? Where is Deontay Wilder in heavyweight boxing? What the hell?
Yeah, it's in an odd place. I mean, Deontay Wilder is a great big, tall, lengthy, aggressive fighter who really hasn't fought many worthwhile opponents. If I was his manager, I would certainly not want to put him against the Joshua or a Klitschko for as long as possible. As a fight fan, I'd like to see him get in there with him because I think that it would strengthen their name to sort of distinguish their talent next to his. I'm not convinced of him yet as a legitimate contender. I'm far more impressed with King Kong. Luis Ortiz, I think, is just a, you know, another guy with some, I think, PED issues, but aside from that, extraordinary puncher, big, powerful, strong guy, 400 years old, so, you know, beware an old man in a hurry. I hope he uses that as an impetus to take on some big opponents. I think he's dangerous to anybody who fights him. I think the heavyweight landscape is kind of intriguing. It'd be interesting to see which way Klitschko, Joshua goes for the future. I think those are the two best that we have. But there are some dangerous opposition out there, and you just have to see where things fall once some of these guys start matching up. I'm not sure right now who's left standing. Potentially they all are left standing, and we get close decisions, and then there's some opportunity to see them all face each other. And And that's always interesting, just to see how the styles match up, because we just can't know the outcomes of that until we watch those fights play out. And maybe there's room, you know, for some pretty interesting kind of round robin like setup. I don't know, but I mean, these guys are just so big, so strong, and powerful. It's an interesting time, finally, for the heavyweights. Like, for me, the most interesting time since, like, the early 90s.
It's pretty much all, like, interesting is pretty much the best we can hope for at this stage, it seems. You know, after so many years of just kind of lamenting the heavyweight division, and largely because of Vladimir Klitschko's dominance of it, you know, it's actually nice for things to actually be in doubt, and for us to not really know what the outcome of this thing is. Of course, the difficult part is having as many of these fighters face each other as possible. That's the tough part. But if we can at least get to a point where, I mean, there's no question that Deontay Wilder, at least to me, belongs in this mix somewhere. I just don't know where yet. And for the reasons you stated, I think that his opposition has been lacking, clearly. It's obviously hindered by, or it obviously had been hindered by, you know, the wall between premier boxing champions and just about everybody else in the sport. But at the same time, even when he was with Golden Boy, they were very clearly protecting him and trying to build him up without really challenging the guy. And he has kind of walked headfirst into a couple of unexpected challenges with guys who were supposed to be, you know, either walkovers or guys who weren't supposed to compete with him. And they were able to just kind of stumble into competing with him. And it seems as though if you put him in with a more competent puncher than some of the guys he's been in with, he probably wouldn't go the distance. Nonetheless, until that happens, he clearly does belong among these other fighters who are kind of scraping at each other to get to the top and to you know, get toward the top of the heap there. But it's just kind of disappointing that he's not already getting in with any of these other fighters that, man, are really making this division more interesting, and he's not really getting any younger. At this point, he's 31. It's you kind of have to start doing something at some point.
Yeah, I think the big fear is the cautionary tale of Michael Grant and essentially where his career went after the Lennox Lewis matchup, because there are a lot of parallels there. You know, Michael Grant looked just a devastating force, this huge guy knocking every single opponent out, fights Lewis and just looks horrible. I mean, blown out of the water in, I think, 2 rounds. So if the same thing happens to Deontay Wilder, that he can't take a heavyweight punch, that he's fighting somebody that's as athletic as he is and has some defense and some composure, he could look really, really bad. It's hard to imagine his career really recovering. A lot of the excitement with him right now is the promise of his potential, of who he could be, where he's actually going to land when he fights these big names. And once we actually see that put into practice, you know, you can't go back. So I'm quite skeptical of his ability, frankly, and I think there's a good reason why he's been protected. But, I mean, a lot of these fighters were very protected. Mike Tyson was very protected with his opponents, was heavily criticized for who he fought initially for the first couple of years of his ascent. People said, you know, like, he's fought absolutely nobody. Why should we take this guy seriously? This excitement is just not commensurate with anything he's achieved. So you never know how it unfolds. I mean, if Deontay Wilder goes on to knock out a Klitschko, knock out Ortiz, knock out Chris Joshua, we'll be saying he's the greatest heavyweight of all time. So it's goofy how this stuff can play out sometimes.
Yeah, they are only a couple of fights away from, you know, the career can turn in a very abrupt moment. There's no question about that. Yeah, it is kind of an exciting time for heavyweight, so that's something that I'm pretty happy about. What are your feelings about Joseph Parker? What do you think about him? Have you seen much of him? Did you see the Ruiz Jr. fight? Did you see any of his fights?
Unfortunately, no. I haven't studied him closely, so I can't offer much on him.
He's at the very least a very, you know, interesting addition to this entire dynamic, although he seems like he kind of has been struggling a bit more than many people expected in his last few. But Andy Ruiz Jr. is actually a pretty good fighter. He just doesn't really ever show up in particularly good shape. That's the unfortunate thing. But no, anyway, Parker, I think, kind of figures into this equation pretty nicely. And after whoever wins that Anthony Joshua Klitschko fight, I think the aim is getting Parker in with whoever wins that fairly quickly, and that's exciting stuff.
Yeah, I'm gonna do my homework on him. I've heard his name come up a lot. I mean, I've caught some of his stuff, but I like to be well versed in people who are in the mix. I just have got caught up with some other stuff.
Well, he hasn't really made his way much onto any U.S. networks or, you know, anything anyway. So it's not really that surprising that any U.S. fans wouldn't have caught him. You kind of have to go out of your way to see him, period, much less live. So anyway, damn, I think that's pretty much it as far as like running through the news and running through what's going on this weekend. Yeah, unless there's anything else going on, dude, let's bring it on home.
You got it. Well, it was great talking.
For sure, man, and apologize everybody for the technical difficulties. I don't know why this happens like once a month or something like that, but nonetheless, thank you so much for joining us, and Bryn, as always, a good time and a great conversation. If you would, if you're on Twitter, please follow Bryn Jonathan Butler at Brynicio, BRINICIO. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor, and also go on to Facebook, like the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there. Follow us, you know, all this kind of stuff. Instagram, blah, blah, blah. Everybody, take it easy. Bryn, you're lovely.
Take care, man. Talk to you soon.